Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the Free Odyssey app.
Michael Busler, how are you? It's been too long.
I'm doing very well, Dawn. Thanks for having me. As you know, it's always my pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you here. So, Professor, will you take us through it? There are so many headlines as we look at financially with Doge, with Trump. So I'll begin with this sovereign wealth fund idea. So we've heard about this in the past. And so Trump signed this and people are saying, what's a sovereign wealth fund? I know he has mentioned this before. I know that countries like, you know, Saudi Arabia have it. I know that some states have it. But what does it mean, sovereign wealth fund? And how does that work for the citizens of this country? Why is that a good thing?
Well, so when there are things that could be purchased, like TikTok is what this is set up for. TikTok is very wildly successful, especially among younger people. And there are a number of small businesses that make their living based on TikTok. The problem is that ByteDance, who owns TikTok, is controlled by the Communist Party in China. And when people go on TikTok, there's a lot of data that can be gathered, and we're never quite sure that China is going to use that data in some nefarious way towards us. So I believe it was last year, it was decided by the U.S. government, all the way up to the Supreme Court, that China can no longer own a majority interest in TikTok. And if they can't divest themselves of that, then there would be a ban on TikTok. Now, literally millions of people do not want a ban on TikTok. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we don't want China collecting some data and using it for bad purposes. So a compromise is that at least 50% of TikTok is purchased, could be by a private investor, although the numbers would be very large. So the federal government said, look, we're going to create this fund where we're able to invest in very large projects like TikTok. Mm-hmm. And at the very least, they'll the deal's not worked out yet, but at the very least, they'll end up owning, if it's not a controlling interest, at least 50%, and they'll be able to control what the Chinese government is able to take out of TikTok in terms of information. So this wealth fund that's being created will provide capital. They're not going to get into a whole lot of purchasing of different services, but ones that are very large and relatively critical to the United States, they'll have the funds to get into it. President Trump is very good at negotiating deals, and he'll now have the capital to be able to negotiate a deal on behalf of the American public that allows TikTok to continue and also prevents any nefarious acts.
And apparently part of this, setting up this wealth fund for national security investments. So that could involve selling. I know Doug Burgum, when he was in the area, and I interviewed him within the past year, and he had, who's obviously now has a cabinet position, but at that time was a governor in the United States of America. So Burgum talked about this kind of a wealth fund that, in other words, let's say at the state level, you have a wealth fund and maybe it's precious metals, or maybe it's oil or something of that nature, that then the people within an entity, whether it's a state or, like I mentioned, Saudi Arabia, I think China has one. How does that all work and how is it managed?
So it comes from taxpayer dollars. So the American public is paying for it. Usually they set up some kind of a management structure. Typically, it has some business people who are very savvy in the business world and some government officials. The business people are concerned with running it like a business so it makes a profit. The government officials are concerned with any national security issues. And you mentioned some products that could have national security implications. So it's usually run by a board that has both government and private enterprise officials.
And you said that taxpayers pay for it, but pay for the maintenance of it? Because I know that Howard Lutnick, who obviously has Pennsylvania ties, billionaire, right, he's one of the people tasked with overseeing this thing, the Sovereign Wealth Fund. But I know he had mentioned, for example, as an example, that when during the first Trump administration, when they had done the deal with all the corporations like Pfizer to incentivize through the private system of try to incentivize a COVID vaccine, Lutnick suggested that, for example, the government should have taken a profit earning stake in the vaccine manufacturers. I know this gets complicated and we're not used to having these conversations, but then it's funded by things that the government invests in or natural resources.
Yeah. So it's funded initially by taxpayers because the government gets all their money from taxpayers, but the actual operations, because you have the business side in there, you shouldn't need any government funding for operations, and the business people will ensure it's profitable. Your question was, what happens with the profit?
Mm-hmm.
Should just the business people take it, or since the government's going to own a significant portion, should some of that go back to the government? And you're right, that raises some kind of sticky issues, and some of that will have to be negotiated to figure out the best way. But if the taxpayers are investing money, they're entitled to some kind of
yes.
a return on that money. So it is sticky, and it will have to be worked out. Some of the other governments that have it don't operate on a free, completely free enterprise system as we do, China, Saudi Arabia, et cetera. So they may be able to allow the government entities to keep profit. Here, it's a little sticky because we operate on a free enterprise system. But as we say, since the taxpayers invested money, they're entitled to a return on that.
Amen. I know we want to get to the issue of tariffs. And so yesterday, all of the headlines said, the market took a nosedive in the futures market before the markets opened throughout the day. Professor, I was not surprised. I was not surprised that our neighbors to the north and south gave in. But your reaction just this morning, as we see they did. Now China, the headline is, your pickup truck is going to cost more. So what's really going on here in your view with regard to tariffs? Is this a trade war?
No, and it won't turn into a trade war either. President Trump is a business person. When a business person has to negotiate something, especially when you have a reluctant partner who doesn't want to negotiate, there's two things that you have to do. First of all, you want to make sure you're negotiating from a position of strength. Secondly, you want to create a sense of urgency that brings the other party to the table. That's exactly allow a 25% tariff on their goods to occur. Why? Their economy, roughly, is a little over $2 trillion annually. About 20% of that, in the $400 billion range, their output comes to the U.S. Now, if Trump imposed a 25% tariff and Americans see higher prices, so they start to look for other things to buy, and instead of 400 being shipped here, only 300 gets shipped here. Well, that's $100 billion drop on a $2 trillion. Economy, that's 5% of their economy going down. That will lead to a severe recession. Making it worse, Trudeau said, if you do that, I'm going to put a 25% tariff on goods you send here. Most of the goods we send there are consumer products. Put on a 25% tariff, most likely the Canadians will pay it. Now, things like peanut butter and maple syrup and things like that. Most likely they'll pay it, which leads to inflation. The worst economic problem to have is what we call stagflation, where you have a stagnant or declining economy with inflation. And that's exactly what would happen. It doesn't surprise me that Trudeau came to the bargaining table and said, look, I'll do what you want, just pause this for a while until we figure this out. Similarly, Mexico is not quite as dependent as Canada, but they're in a similar position where the 25% tariff and or any retaliation would cause them tremendous economic harm. Trump's purpose, primarily, he wants better trade arrangements, but primarily he wants the border secured. He's tired of people coming in from the south with drugs and whatever they have, and now they're coming in from the north. So his primary purpose was to get the border secured as soon as possible. Mexico said, I'm sending 10,000 soldiers to the border there permanently. Trudeau said, not only am I sending 10,000 people to the border, I'm going to spend $1.3 billion to secure the border. Mm-hmm. So in virtually 48 hours from the time he announced this, President Trump had commitments to have the border completely secured. And that was the initial purpose. Now, the secondary purpose is, even though he renegotiated NAFTA when he came into office the first time to get the USMCA, there is still a huge imbalance in trade between the U.S. and both Mexico and Canada. He needs to get that fixed. Canada doesn't even allow American banks to operate in Canada. And there are a few other things. So he wants to get that fixed. So the tariffs secured the border literally in 48 hours, and or at least commitments to secure it. And he'll give them 30 days to negotiate a fair trade deal, or he's going to put these tariffs back on. And neither Canada or Mexico can afford to have that happen.
Which brings us to China, right? Because that's 12:01 a.m. President said, you know, China, this is going into effect. The markets are, it looks like, remaining stable. Your take on number three, China.
Right. So too much of our critical goods and services are produced in China, medical equipment, pharmaceuticals, that sort of thing. Some of the batteries and things that we need. Too much of that is made in China. He wants to bring production back to the U.S. Number one, maybe that's not number one. Maybe number one is he wants to stop China from making all this fentanyl that finds its way to both Canada and Mexico and comes into the country. So he secured the border. Now he wants China to stop making it. So he's going to put those tariffs on. Those tariffs will hurt the Chinese economy much more than they'll hurt us. And look, it may turn out that there is a little bit of pain in the short run in that maybe prices will be a little higher. But as the prices go up, it becomes more attractive for manufacturers to produce in the U.S. Look, the reason they're in China in the first place is China pays their workers, you know, $1 mm-hmm. an hour, and we pay significantly more than that. So it's cheaper to make things there and bring it over here. But President Trump says, well, look, if I put these tariffs on, the price of their goods will go up. Now maybe it's not so much cheaper to make it in China. Plus, Trump said, any manufacturer who is making a product in China and brings it back to the U.S. to produce it, he'll lower the tax rate from the corporate rate of 21% down to 15%. The goal here, immediately, he'd like to fix the fentanyl problem. And he's sort of done that by protecting the borders, but he'd like to do more by having China stop making it. But the longer-term goal is to bring production back to the U.S. And Trump has said, look, if you want to avoid any tariffs, stop making it in China and start making it here. Now, the companies will answer back, yeah, but it's more expensive to make it here. Even if you cut the taxes and do other, it's still going to be more expensive. Mm-hmm. So what American manufacturers are going to have to do is to figure out how to make the product less expensive, probably by using less labor and more capital. In other words, we used to make cars, an assembly line with a whole lot of people there. Now we have robots on the assembly line rather than people, and it keeps the production cost down. similarly, I believe that's what's going to happen with goods that we bring back from China to the U.S. We'll produce them more capital intensive. You know, we have artificial intelligence, automation, mm-hmm. robots. So more capital intensive rather than labor intensive. Still be jobs created, but they won't be kind of the factory jobs that, you know, we're used to seeing decades ago. Those things are probably going to be minimized in the future. But the idea is to bring the goods back here so we can make them here, so China won't be in a position to hold us hostage. I remember during the COVID, suddenly everybody needed halfway over here, and China said, wait a minute, we need the masks too. Turned the ship around, took it back, and we had a shortage of masks, which drove the cost of a 40 or 50% mask up to $5.
It's crazy.
Now, the market responded to that by producing more, but still, we don't want China in a position to do that, especially with critical products.
And I know we're continuing the conversation with Stockton Professor Michael Bussler, but I wanted to ask you about this, you know, proposal today, Michael, where they're saying the proposal would be, it was a campaign promise that they would try to put forth bipartisan legislation that would get credit card companies on board to lower, maybe Trump had suggested, I remember on the campaign trail, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he had said 10%. So just for a pause, just for a time to let people, obviously it's to spur the economy, but to let people kind of catch up and pay off credit cards. What do you make of that and just your reaction to that?
So the idea of it sounds very good. A business should be able to still make a profit charging 10%, and some consumers are paying double that would get a break. The problem is, what would happen is there wouldn't be credit cards available to people who are not the most solid credit risks. In other words, the reason card companies charge 20% to many people is that many people have had some credit problems and the credit card company is not sure they're going to get paid. So in order to offset that risk, they charge a higher rate. So if you cap the rate at 10%, some people that have had some credit issues in the past may have difficulty getting credit cards. So I support the idea of helping the middle class by lowering interest rates. The real way to do that is it's going to take a little time. Mm-hmm. Trump will vastly increase the supply of energy. Energy accounts for about 8% of the CPI directly and about 30% indirectly through what it costs manufacturers. So he'll increase the supply of energy. Energy prices will fall. As energy prices fall, the inflation rate will go down. And as the inflation rate goes down, that will lead to lower interest rates. Now, people who are paying 20% on their credit card certainly don't want to hear, well, maybe a year from now it will be lower. I have a problem today, and I'm sympathetic to that. But by capping the interest rate at 10%, there won't be credit available to anybody unless they have perfect credit and never made a mistake on anything.
Well, let me ask you something. Does this headline surprise you? Here's the headline this morning. This is Bernie Sanders teaming up. This is probably the most unlikely team. I'm trying to think of like a sports team that's unlikely. But this is Senator Bernie Sanders and Josh Hawley teaming up, introducing this bipartisan legislation to cap credit card interest rates at 10%, working together and saying they're, and this is from the Sanders. I looked at this. I thought, is this a joke? Is somebody spoofing me? But Sanders put out the statement. He said Trump pledged to cap the credit card interest rates at 10%. And Sanders and Hawley proud to introduce bipartisan legislation. And this is Sanders releasing the news release, by the way, to do that. It looks like a temporary thing. But what do you make of that?
Again,
is it good,
bad? I think it's a great idea to help the public. I'm just nervous about capping it at 10%. Anybody who has any problem on their credit, look, everybody's had an issue at one point or another. Anybody who has issues with their credit may be denied credit in the future if they can only charge 10%, unless all the interest rates came down, and that's something different. But at the current level of interest rates today, where the, you know, the prime rates in the 7.5-8% range, it's very difficult for the credit card companies to justify.
Yes.
I mean, if they're paying 8% for their capital and you're lending it essentially at 10%, that's only a 2% spread, which is okay if everybody pays. But if there's some people in credit cards, everybody doesn't always end up paying 100%. And if that's the case, then they have some losses, then it really won't pay them to give credit. So I support the spirit of the idea. I haven't seen the details. Maybe there's some way that they can offset some of the bank's risk, but I'm a little nervous about credit being extended to the average person.
And I apologize that I'm obviously throwing all of this at you because there's so much breaking news this morning, Professor. But the truth is, I think what I infer here is that this particular piece of legislation would be for people who right now have credit cards that are at, you know, that have risen to 28% over time, and you're trying to pay off something that's existing. Do you know what I'm saying? That's what I'm inferring. But then, to your point, first of all, you know the banks, like, what do they get out of it? Because that's what the devil lies in the details. You know they're going to get something out of it. And then do we get charged on our taxes? As I, you know, there are obviously some details that we don't have here.
Well, I believe what you're suggesting is that 10% only applies to credit that's already been extended.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't apply to new credit, but only credit that's already been extended, you're kind of minimizing some of the negative aspects that I see on it. I'm worried about people getting credit. But if it only applies to existing credit, and I haven't seen the details, but maybe it's only short term to allow people to get out of the hole that they dug themselves into. And Josh Hawley is very conservative. So if he supports this and puts his name on it, there's probably some kind of provisions in there to offset any of the negative impacts. I'll be very anxious to go ahead and read this bill and see what it actually says.
Yeah, I can't wait. Well, it's so good to hear you every time you're on, and it's been too long. The floodgates open. Everybody loves you and really appreciates just your common sense explanations of a lot of complex, fast-moving details. So, Professor Michael Bussler, Stockton University, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dawn. Look forward to doing it again.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.